Don't ask me about the Cuban refugees. Whatever you do, don't ask me about the Cuban refugees. Hey kids, this is Combat Chuck. You may recognize me from such hits as Five Iron Frenzy, Goaty Hook Banana Man cover, all sorts of fun and interesting things, but you'll love me and you'll love this podcast because it's about me.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Dominate.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man, being realistic.
As the story grows.
I always wanted to be part of a small rebellion.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it.
Boom. Hey, everybody. This is Combat Chuck, and I love this song because it's about me.
So thanks for coming on the show.
Man, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm glad we could finally do this. I don't remember Jeff Ballou mentioning you. You said he mentioned you on his episode?
They were telling a story. He was telling a story about... We were on tour with Goaty Hook and Stavesacre and I believe the Supertones.
Yeah.
And we were in a hotel lobby... because when you're on tour, you start betting on everything. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You can find a way to bet on it. Right. And so we're in this hotel lobby to recap, episode. I don't know what the episode was, but, to recap the Jeff Ballou episode, he was telling this awesome story about we're in this, hotel lobby and basically, this lady is irate and she's just having this, you know, meltdown. It's like a Bridezilla kind of thing. And she's like erupting and she keeps saying, I know, I know, I know. And I guess Jeff said, I'll bet you like 10 bucks. She'll say it 10 more times or something. And we were like, I'll take that. I mean, you know, it's like a Wall Street, you know, there's money changing hands all over the place. It's this bedlam. And she literally is just on this tirade. I know you can do this. I know you can do better. I know that. And she's, you know, kind of building up. And she gets to like seven after she had said it. She must have said it like 20 times. She gets to the end of her rant, walks away, and we're all like, no, you're so close. And she's at like 7 out of 10. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, after we thought she had walked away and was done for good, she comes back to this manager guy and is like, I know, I know, I know you can do it. And like the entire right side of the this hotel lobby just erupts, like all these, like, you know, punk rock looking dudes. And it looked like, you know, I think the day before we actually got kicked out of a mall for looking like a gang. Like we lit in Lincoln, Nebraska. Jeff didn't talk about this. In Lincoln, Nebraska, we got escorted out of the mall by security because everybody was in black hoodies and black jeans and had short hair. And there were so many of us, they thought we were a gang and they made us all leave. True story.
Oh my goodness.
Ask the Supertones, ask Goaty Hook, ask Stavesacre. It's all true.
I feel that tour has been talked about, I feel, on a bunch of podcasts between the Stavesacre and Goaty Hook guys, but I've never heard about that tour talked about from any of the Supertone guys. I feel like I should reach out to them and ask them about that tour, because
it
seems like there was camaraderie between Goaty Hook and Stavesacre that wasn't there with the Supertone guys, and I remember going to that tour, so
Well, I mean, to be fair, it's like at the time, I mean, I don't remember how much money they were making on merch, but I mean, like, they were absolutely destroying everybody, like, every night, like, financially. It would be, you know, the Supertones would get a Happy Meal, or the Goaty Hook and Staves Acre would get, like, a Happy Meal and large fries, and the Supertones would walk away with the whole franchise, you know what I mean? Like, every night. And yeah. So I think there was a natural camaraderie there. Everybody got along, but it was definitely like that was their tour, or at least it felt like from my perspective, it was like that was their tour, and you know it was cool of them to let Goaty Hook and Staves Acre come along. But I mean, like it was a great bill. Like every night, there were so many good stories from that tour. So one of the things, like the way that I got onto that tour was. I was the quote-unquote merch guy after the shows for Goaty Hook. I was on the cover of their Banana Man record, which is like a whole different. That's like a whole different. We'll tell that story in a minute because that's great. It ends with the children beating me unmercifully. So we're out on this tour, and every night it became this thing where I would introduce. Goaty Hook and we would just do stupid stuff like, you know, all right, Goaty Hook, give it to me 22 times, and they would like, you know, do these big like dun 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 dun, like, you know, the full band hitting like, you know, the rock and roll like big power chord with the whole band doing these hits. But I would just like make up a number, all right, Goaty Hook, give it to me 32 times, and and it would just become ridiculous. So at some point during the tour, we would start again betting. There was a lot of betting on this so-called Christian rock and roll tour. Sorry, moms and aunts. So we're out on this tour, and as we're going along, about halfway through, they decide to... They're giving me, like, challenges because I can, like, memorize, like, long passages of different... movie scripts and stuff like that. So right before, they would all write down as many things as they could on a piece of paper. I would memorize them and then walk out to the crowd and just deliver this nonsensical speech made up of the stuff that was just written down two minutes beforehand. So I'd come out and I would do like pieces of Hamlet and like quotes from like Bono from U2 and quotes from like Billy Graham and quotes like all these different things. But then I would have to weave in all of the stuff that they had written down on the side of the stage. So I'd be looking over like, you know, and they would be counting on their hands, like how many I had got on the list. And this became like a whole nother level of introducing a band, right? So I get like 2 or 3 minutes to introduce the band and basically just make up stuff every night. And then that devolved into getting the crowd to boo me every night, which was awesome. And I would just find ways to get the crowd to hate me. So that's why, you know, the kids never heard much more from Combat Chuck, because I was hated across the industry. You've just lost all your listeners. They've all tuned out.
Where did you grow up, man? Where are you originally from? I know you're currently in Missouri, but where are you originally from?
So we moved around. We didn't move around a lot, but I moved around a bunch when I was a kid. Sorry. So I was born in Jacksonville, Florida, and then we moved back to Springfield or the Springfield, Missouri area, and I lived there till I was like 10, and then we moved to Oklahoma, and then we moved to Virginia. And Virginia is like where I really feel like that's home to me because I went to high school there. Like all my close friends are in Virginia. And so I started playing in bands out of high school, got my, you know, got a job at a local recording studio as a intern and was watching people make records, and then kind of went to college for like 5 minutes and realized this is not for me. And then, you know, again, started like writing my own music, playing in bands, and kind of touring with all kinds of different, you know, friends from DC. And I go out, I just love being on the road. So I would go out as a merch guy on some tours, and I come back, and then I go out with my band, like playing bass, you know, and we were called Pool. And for serious fans of the Christian recordings, Harry, who started Pool, was in a band called The Throes way back in the day. They were like 89 90 91, and they were on a record label called REX Records, and put out a couple of records. And so I started playing with Pool, and then we started doing, like, we never broke, but we always had really awesome gigs. Like, we'd play in New York, and we'd play at Roseland Ballroom in New York, and it would be like we'd be opening up for somebody, maybe a sold out show, and it was just, we had a really good string of just great shows, opening for really great bands. We, you know, played with Guided by Voices, Flaming Lips in Rochester, New York. You know, opened for Joan Jett one time, almost ran her over with our van. That's a different story. You know, just all kinds of stuff. And so that was like kind of my, that's what I was really doing. And then like the Combat Chuck thing and like hanging out with like Goaty Hook and Supertones and all that, that was kind of like almost my side gig. So I go out and do like a month or two with them, and I come back and we'd like make a record with Pool. And then I'd do something with another band, and I'd come back and we would, I would make like a solo record or something like that. So then about 98, 97, 98, I started going to California all the time, and ended up getting a publishing deal as a songwriter. And so I kind of migrated out west in 98 and lived out there for 4 or 5 years. And then we moved back to DC for a little while, and then finally ended up here in 2007 in Springfield, Missouri, and we absolutely love it here. So that is the short encapsulated geographical moves of Combat Chuck, Sean Matthews, Paul Masters.
Scott Hatch from Burnt Toast Vinyl has a brewery in my neighborhood. So I hang out with him quite often.
I like Scott Hatch.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Nothing not to love. And I mentioned you were gonna come on the show, and he mentioned your band, and I couldn't remember it, so it had to have been Pool.
Yeah, he loves Pool. He was a Pool fan, and a while back we were actually talking about doing some sort of a vinyl reissue of one of the Pool records, and he was spearheading that. Like, how can we make that happen? So, you know, that's not out of the realm of possibility. But again, we were never huge, so it was like, we had a limited fan base. I mean, we sold records, but, you know, we didn't sell, like, crazy amounts of records.
So how did you get into music originally?
From the time that I was a kid, like, I have been listening to records from, age 5 or 6, I remember listening to Blonde. Like my friend next door had this crazy turntable that had all these like 70s lights. It looked like a jukebox, but it was not a jukebox. It was just this fancy record player that had these lights that came on when it played, you know, music and stuff. And this is like, you know, 1977 or 78. So it was mind blowing, you know? And we would listen to Blondie and The Clash and, you know, just all this cool stuff, because, you know, he had like older brothers, Kiss, obviously, and he had older brothers. And so they would like buy records, and then we would listen to their records when they weren't around. And, you know, I just remember being fascinated. It was almost like I always felt like I could touch the music coming out of the speakers. Like it was like almost a tangible thing to me. And so I've always loved sound. I've always loved electronics. And I used to be the kid who would try like take apart like the radio and then try to put it back together. I still can't put it back together, but I'm very good at taking them apart. I can take anything apart. It's a skill, you know. And then it just, you know, I got a guitar and like tried to learn how to play when I was like 8 or 9 and couldn't figure it out. And then when I was like 13 or 14, like something clicked, and then I got a guitar and just played like 8 hours a day, just as I would come home from school and lock myself in my room and just play guitar over. And I mean, like go to dinner, you know, eat dinner for like 10, 15 minutes and then go right back to playing. And it was like, I think it kept me out of a lot of trouble and it gave me like a focus. And I knew what I wanted to do when I was 14, you know, like I never was like, oh, I want to be a senator or something. I always wanted to play music or be around music. And I've been fortunate enough. I mean, I've been basically working for myself for 30 years and have been self-employed by, you know, whether it's owning my own business or being a freelancer or whatever. And it hasn't been full time in music, but I've always been around music because of the things that I've done. And so I'm really fortunate, really blessed to be able to say that. And it's just awesome. You know, I love what I do. So
that's cool. And growing up in that Arlington Falls Church area, that's how you got connected with the Goaty Hook guys, right?
Yeah. I don't think it was their first show, but, do you know a band, Jason Hammaker from Frotus and Decahedron?
Oh, yeah. I love Frotus. And yeah, Jason was a former guest on this show.
Oh, Jason's awesome. I love Jason so much.
Yeah, we went to church together for a little while.
Oh, right on.
In DC. Yeah.
So I don't remember the exact chronology of this, but I think one of the first Frotus shows. So back in the day, I was doing this. It was like an acoustic guitar, like folk thing, which I was horrible. I mean, it was just horrible. But like I always managed, because I'm a marketing guy, I always managed to figure out like either how to put shows together or like how to get a bill together and stuff like that. And so I don't remember if this is all one show or two or three shows over like a 2 or 3 week period, but I'm pretty sure like one of the very first Goaty Hook shows and one of the first Frotus shows, I was on either a three or four act bill and I was one of the acts, or it was two different bills. But anyway, those were like almost like their first shows for those bands. Like I think they had played like one or two times maybe each of the bands. So it's just like, cause I'm like 6 or 7 years older than the Goaty Hook guys. So, it was like when they were like 17 or 18, I was like 24 or 25, you know what I mean? So, I don't know. It just, I think that early show was probably when I met them, and it was like 90, 93, maybe 93 or 94, somewhere in there. And they had just started. Yeah. So my memory is failing me, but it's somewhere around there. That's when we all met.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So were they your gateway into the, obviously into the Tooth and Nail and like the Christian scene then?
Sort of. I mean, I had listened to a bunch. They were definitely my entry into the whole Christian punk, like Tooth and Nail scene and all that. I wouldn't have met like the Stavesacre guys. I don't think I would have met any of those guys if it wasn't for the Goaty Hook guys. Maybe because of Cornerstone, but because we were going out to Cornerstone like every, I think I went from like 89 or 90 to like 96 or 97. So I might have met people there, but I know that the Goaty Hook guys played like a big part for me in terms of like meeting people and being introduced to that scene and stuff like that. But I was familiar. I mean, it wasn't like I had never heard any of that stuff. So,
okay.
Yeah. So okay. I never wanted to put out records on that side of the fence. It was like, I didn't have anything against it. I kind of had like this vision for what I wanted to do. And, you know, I just kind of went my own path, I guess.
That Five Iron Frenzy debut came out in 96 as well, right? If I'm not mistaken. So how did you meet the Five Iron Frenzy guys where you were...
Okay.
I guess maybe we'll go back in how did Combat Chuck come around this time?
This is the Combat Chuck origin story. And to be quite honest, I don't think I've ever told this in a public forum. Like, I've told a few people... But, I mean, there aren't that many people that... Because you have to understand, like, when we were all said and done, I mean, I calculated the number of people that we were in front of and, like, all the aggregate fan bases and media opportunities and all that stuff. And, I mean, like, when it's all said and done, it's probably... We probably reach, like, a million people with the Combat Chuck brand, if you will, with the name.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that was like a big deal until I was a couple of years ago is at this I was at South by Southwest and for the interactive portion, and we're sitting around and I'm with like these kind of big wig social media people from, you know, it's like some like the head of social for Southwest Airlines and this lady from this big PR firm. And a buddy of mine who had witnessed like the whole Combat Chuck thing was telling the story of how he basically, you know, he had witnessed this whole Combat Chuck thing, and their like jaws are dropped and they're sitting there trying to figure out like, wait, what? And I was like, yeah, you know, I did this and I did this, and I'm like kind of explaining the story, and they're literally like, how did you do that? And when I told them that, you know, I built basically a million person, like, it wasn't a fan base. I call it a fan base, but I mean, like, that's shorthand. But I mean, the market penetration, to use a, you know, 2007 marketing term, was, you know, close to a million people. And I spent $300, and this is before social media, you know. There was no Facebook. This is all grassroots and all that. And they were just kind of, like, blown away. And I'm, like, looking at their faces going, what, doesn't everybody do that? And I hadn't really thought about it until that point. I'm like, oh, this is kind of a marketable skill. And it was honestly like I started doing a lot more, marketing and that kind of thing, social media and these campaigns and stuff like that for bigger brands and blah, blah, blah. But that's not why we're here. So the Combat Chuck story, if you notice, I go off on a lot of tangents and I apologize for that. So basically it was Cornerstone 95 and I was in, have you ever been to a Cornerstone music festival?
Oh yes, a few. Yeah.
I know that there are many of your listeners who probably have been, but to paint a picture for those who hadn't been, this is a giant Christian music festival in the mid-90s. I don't remember the dates, but it was, you know, somewhere in the 70s to somewhere in the early 2000s this thing ran. It moved locations a couple of times, but it was, when I went, it was in the middle of a cornfield in Bushnell, Illinois, and yep. it was literally just the little tiny town, a slightly bigger town, Macomb, Illinois, and then, you know, 10, 15,000 people would come in for this festival. Might have been more. I don't know. I wasn't counting. But basically, it's the middle of a cornfield, and then they would set up these tents, and bands would play. You know, they had four or five tents, and there would be, you know, different bands always playing. And then it was incredible. And so there was a merch tent where everybody sold all of their, you know, CDs and hoodies and sweatshirts and stickers and all that stuff. And I was in this tent, and I had just come from some radio festival in D.C. where I was backstage and, like, hanging out. And it was, like, this just crazy bill. And I'm standing at this Cornerstone tent, and I hear this guy from a band that people have heard of, and they were fairly popular at the time, and he was complaining about, like, you know, the backstage accommodations or like the sandwiches backstage or something. And it was just so, it just rubbed me the wrong way. Like, you know, dude, I like go out and play clubs like all the time, and we're lucky to, if we get 100 people there and like we sell like $50 worth of merchandise, we're like stoked, right? Like we're trying to get gas money to get to the next gig. And I'm like looking on the other side of this, and there's these bands that are like making 10 grand a night, and we're just like, what's going on? Like, you know, it's just crazy. And so it just struck me the wrong way that this guy was like kind of complaining about their situation, and like it almost seemed like ungrateful or unthankful, and it just bugged me. And I turned to my friend and I was like, dude, anybody can be a star in this environment. I bet you a dollar I can like create a brand, like create a like band name, fictional band name or character or something like that. And I can get just as popular. And like my buddy's like, there's no way. And I was like, I can do it. And so I literally said that, made the bet, because remember, it always comes back to betting. That is the theme of this show, is off track betting and other parlor games. There you go. I turned to my friend and I was like, dude, watch this. And literally within 2 seconds, just sidetrack on the name, this girl that I knew gave me a card from like a pair of plastic nunchucks that still exist to this day, that said Combat Chuck, and I just added the real life superhero. And so she said, this guy kind of looks like you. Is like a little cartoon character on this packaging. And I thought, yeah, that that's funny. And this is like 3 or 4 months before, and I didn't think anything of it, but I needed a name, like, because I was going to, you know, win my dollar bet. And so I turn around and I just said, "Hi, I'm Combat Chuck, real life superhero. Would you like to meet me?" And I just started introducing myself to every single person that I ran into. And so this kind of escalated with, I can't remember the exact timeline, if I met Lee Bingham at that point from Sixpence None the Richer, or Reese from Five Iron. I don't know who I met first, but basically I was kind of hanging out with both of them, and I'm like, they see me doing my, you know, my shuck and jive routine with all these people, and I'm like introducing myself left and right, and they think it's funny and all that. And so then Lee is playing on the main stage that night in front of, like, you know, again, probably 10,000 people. And in the middle of a song, she just kind of, or like the middle of their set, they kind of stop, and she says, "If anybody's seen Combat Chuck's wallet, can you please return it to the main stage or something?" And then she said something else like, "Combat Chuck, your mom's looking for him." And so she made like two Combat Chuck references. And this is after I'd spent a day of, I'd probably introduced myself at that point to like, probably 1,000 people, like, no lie. Just, I'm like telling everybody I can meet, "Hi, I'm Combat Chuck, you know, would you like to meet me?" And then we started doing like these crazy stunts, like punk rock rodeo and whatnot. And so the next day after she said that, I start introducing myself, but now people have heard of me. And so people are like, "Oh dude, I've totally heard of you. What's your deal? Are you in a band? Are you a, you know, like," and what's funny, that the funniest thing about this whole deal is all of the stories that people would make up, like that they thought what Combat Chuck was, what they thought it meant. You know, some people thought I was in a band. Some people thought I was like some sort of performance artist. Some people thought I was a youth pastor. Some people thought I was, this one guy made up this thing about, you know, "Oh, it means, so you want to get rid of combat. You're like to chuck or throw away combat." And I was like, "Yeah, man, exactly." So then, you know, fast forward a year later, the next cornerstone, Five Iron had written this song about me and had, you know, had called me and said, "Hey, can you record like a little intro for this song?" And so I did that. And then the next year I called, 1996 was the Combat Chuck Youth Explosion. And we basically made up like t-shirts and delegate badges. Like I had these, it said Combat Chuck Youth Explosion official delegate, and we would go around and get people to sign up. Like they would just like write their name on the name badge. It was like those convention badge type things, and so they'd write their name on their badge, make up a character name, and then put that badge on their shirt or whatever, and then they would be like part of the Combat Chuck Youth Explosion. And then we made t-shirts, and then I also had a disinformation campaign about Combat Chuck that were like, was a little bit more official. So like, Combat Chuck is not God. You should not be worshiping Combat Chuck. You know, like, you should really look at. So I covered all sides of the spectrum, including, of course, pro-Combat Chuck propaganda. And at that point, I'd met more bands and had toured a little bit more. And so that's like where it really blew up. And then Goaty Hook put me on the cover of their record in the Banana Man suit, or for the Banana Man cover.
The banana suit, yeah.
Yeah, the banana suit. And that, so that to me is like the quintessential, you know, when I think about my proudest moments as a human being, It was that whole day, because at that point I still smoked cigarettes, and so the entire day I spent in a banana costume with these like brown, it was like a brown leotard underneath the thing. So it was like polyester and hot. And you being from the Northern Virginia, DC metropolitan area, you know what an August day is like. It is miserable.
Yeah, and awful.
Like, it's like humidity beyond anything that is comprehensible. And so I'm angry. I am mad and frustrated. But I mean, to be fair, Goaty Hook was paying me like $50. So it's like, you know, I was half excited, you know, to be a part of this adventure. And then the other half of me was just like really mad that I was like in a banana suit in 98 degree weather. And then that again was when you're walking around near the U.S. Capitol in a costume, people assume that you have some sort of political bent
agenda,
yeah. Right? And so people are coming up and they were asking me, so are you what are you protesting? Why are you here today? Like just random people. And I would, you know, say things like, well, I'm here to prevent the deforestation of banana plants across the South American region and in parts of Alaska and wherever we can find and eradicate all banana species. And like people are like, wait, are you for it or against it? And I'm like, I don't know. Are you for it or against it? And I would just get into these like random debates with people about whether or not we should have bananas and if bananas were acceptable as a fruit for breakfast to put in cereal. You know, it kept spiraling out of control, and it was stupid and it was fun and it was wonderful. But the photographer's like, hey, we should go in the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, and get some shots, right? We should get some photos inside the U.S. Capitol. Now, the Goaty Hook guys are dressed. If you've ever seen the pictures from that Banana Man record, they're in like, they're kind of like slightly fancier than street clothes, you know, like their hair's all done up and, you know, they are looking the part of a modern, you know, punk pop band. And so they don't look like the typical person walking into the U.S. Capitol. They're not in suits. They're just in t-shirts and tattoos all over the place. And so they literally walk right in ahead of me. And the security guards don't even hardly bat an eye. They're like, you know, saying, welcome, you know, come through, et cetera, et cetera. And there's like five or six of us in the entourage, and I'm the last person, and I kind of am trying to, like, you know, get this banana suit through the narrow, you know, security checkpoint and going through the
oh my god,
the metal detectors and all that.
Yeah, the Capitol.
Yeah, I mean, this is U.S. Capitol. Now, to be fair, this is pre 9/11, so the security was much much more loose. But anyway, so I'm going through this metal detector, and I just feel like the security wand, like the kind of mobile metal detector, I just feel it like pressing against my stomach, and the guy looks at me and he just says, like, in this stern U.S. Capitol Police voice, sir, is there any particular reason why you're coming into the U.S. Capitol in a banana suit? And I've never had, you know how like you always want to say like the perfect thing, but you think of it like 5 minutes after. I had like a moment of clarity and a moment of zen and a moment of excellence all at the same time. I just look at him straight in the face and I go, I'm a taxpayer. And the guy looks at me, he's like, welcome to the people's house. And I walk right in. It's like, apparently that's all you have to say to get in the U.S. Capitol in any sort of costume is, I'm a taxpayer, and that is the magic key. So, yeah. So that's how I got in the U.S. Capitol in a banana suit. A fact that I am very proud of to this very day. I put it on resumes. And then like 5 minutes later, we're outside on the, you know, where the carousel is in relationship to. So we're at that carousel and this group of kids, it's actually on there. There's a poster of this in the original packaging for the Banana Man LP. There's this picture of these kids chasing me and they're all dressed in like these, like, you know, it's like a, either a Catholic school or Montessori school or something, but they're all in the same uniforms. And the photographer and the band are all, the photographer's taking pictures of me and the band is over to the right and they're all looking at me. And I am surrounded by like 40 or 50 kids. And at one point somebody says, "Get him!" Like this little kid's like, "Get him!" And another one nails me right, I mean, just south of the border. And the Banana Man costume has no padding whatsoever. And I drop to my knees. I mean, it's just like, I'm out. And all of a sudden, I'm now being tackled and pummeled by a group of like these eight or 9 year old kids. And they're like kicking and like spitting on me. And I mean, they were like going to tear me apart if somebody didn't stop. And so I look up like, okay, this isn't funny anymore. Combat Chuck / Banana Man is like literally going to die on the steps of the, you know, or on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol. I'm going to die. And I look over and literally every single member of the band is doubled over laughing. I found no salvation or rescue from the hands of Goatee Hook that day. And a fact that I'm still bitter about to this day.
Very bitter about. Oh, yeah. Man.
So, yeah, that's pretty much the full Combat Chuck story in a in an encapsulated format.
Yeah, and in 2003, Five Iron Frenzy put the official, they said Combat Chuck had passed away.
Yeah, I mean, which really, they had no right to do that since it was not their intellectual property. So
they killed him anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we've been in court for about 7 years now, I think. Because they really had no right to do that. And so at some point we'll settle, but you know.
They probably still got Kickstarter money they could send you.
I mean, you know, seriously, like, I'm not angry about it, but, you know, it would be nice if they, I never expected to profit off of the, you know, the winnings of that the Combat Chuck franchise brought them, but to kill it when they didn't even have the right to do so. I mean, it's just, it's a little painful, but that's all right.
Yeah.
It's fine. Well, we both have good lawyers. Combat Chuck has passed away. His dying wish was never played. That song. Oh,
yeah. And Giddy Doggy's poison. It's funny that you mentioned Kickstarter because I was just talking to...
Who was I talking to? I know her as Jeff, but her real name is Lenora, right?
That's Leonore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Leonore.
So now I'm questioning it, and she told me, she's like, "You never said my real name out loud, did you?" And I was like, "No." And now that I'm doing it, I'm completely... So if you're listening, I'm very sorry. But anyway, we were talking, because they have like... that new documentary that they're working on about like the whole like third wave ska thing and all that, which should be
ska movie.
And I was talking to her under the guise of, you know, we're making a documentary right now about what I call the Music Maker Revolution. My wife and I bought this old recording studio in Springfield, Missouri a couple of and it was like the beginning of this year, and this studio has a really interesting history. Springfield, Missouri itself has an interesting history, and then like my background with like again like the whole Combat Chuck thing and being a part. I mean, I have a lot of great memories of like just like those guys, and like, you know, I still keep in touch with like Dirk from, you know, Staves Acre, and I talk to Jeff every once in a while, and you know, just we have a lot of, there's just a lot of great stories and a lot of great memories from that time. But what I think is interesting is like where a lot of these guys have gone after the whole music thing kind of ended. You know, even though people are still in bands and they still play out and stuff like that, like everybody kind of has like some really cool careers, and they're doing some really cool stuff, you know. And so I think that that's at least worth like 5 or 10 minutes of talking about, like as part of here's kind of where I came from, and these are what a lot of my friends are doing now. And I think it's really, in terms of like who I am as a person, that whole time period had a huge effect on me, like personally. And I miss seeing those guys all the time and all that. And so I just kind of want to tell a little bit of my perspective of like that story and what I thought was cool about it. And, you know, the guys that are still out there and doing some cool stuff and all that. And then it's about, you know, this documentary is about also, you know, there's never been a more exciting time for musicians and creatives of all types. I mean, you can literally record anywhere and everywhere now. And, you know, I've seen over the last like 5 years, 5 or 10 years, this explosion of music makers, people making instruments, boutique instrument makers, then the next level down, people making parts for the used instrument or for the boutique instrument makers, right? So it's like there are knob companies making custom knobs for custom pedal makers. And, you know, you'll hear the headlines say things like the music industry is dead and downloads are no longer being sold on iTunes and all this stuff. And you would think that this whole industry is completely imploded, but the opposite is true. There's like, it's never been more exciting to be a musician or a creative. And so it's like really a celebration and an exploration of going out and finding like all these different people that are making cool music or making cool gear for musicians or programmers or, you know, people doing stuff with robotics and music and just all the different facets. So we're really excited. We're getting ready to launch a Kickstarter at the beginning of the year for that. And we've shot about 20 interviews and have about 20 or 30 more probably that we're going to do. And it should be a really cool project, but, you know, that's a lot of what, but a lot of it always comes back to these relationships that I built, you know, in the mid 90s with all these guys. And I love them and I miss them. And, you know, if you're out there and we've met before, like, I'd love to hear from you.
That's cool. Is that what you're currently doing with the Swagbot, or is that separate?
Well, so Swagbot is like Swagbot Creative is our creative agency. And so we do a lot of branding and marketing and social media campaigns. And, you know, it's kind of crazy. We're here in the Midwest and we've managed to work with a bunch of, you know, a number of billion-dollar brands ranging from eHarmony to Wikipedia, Upwork, a company that just went public like last week or the week before. You know, these and just big O'Reilly Auto Parts, big brands, right? And we've done it from the Midwest instead of having to be on the coast, which, you know, is kind of a, in its own way, kind of a punk rock move, you know, that we don't have to be like right down the street from Silicon Valley and we're still doing cool, relevant work, you know? So,
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So one other thing I definitely want to talk about was before Kickstarter, you helped Andy Zip crowdfund The Long Tail.
Yeah, that was another one of those, like, we, Andy and I, like, I really feel like I'm actually using, I know he still uses a lot of the stuff that we did together. I'm using a lot of that stuff as well. Like in terms of, I feel like we almost wrote the playbook of post record company, like independent artist, independent career artist, in this new kind of digital age, because before there was plenty of independent artists, but they hadn't really figured out like the downloads and download cards and all of this, you know, streaming and not to say that we figured it all out, but we were very early adopters in a lot of these different technologies, and it was pretty awesome. I'm still using, like when I start developing artists now, I'm using some of the tricks and things that we did back in the day, because it's just, you know, we had a kind of a motto or a mantra or whatever you want to call it, of one fan at a time. And if you look at the way that really good engagement, I know that this is not what this podcast is about, but it's applicable to anybody listening, like whether they're growing a business or you know, their band or, you know, whatever. It's like when you build things one person at a time, it's slow, but it lasts. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away. If I can get five people to be like, dude, that guy's cool, I want to like check out his, you know, I want to check out his page or check out his studio or whatever it is, those five people are going to be with me for the next X amount of years versus, you know, trying to fake and game your way into, we have 20,000 followers, we have 10,000 fans, we have 100,000 fans. It's like, yeah, that stuff is great for showing numbers to somebody, but at the end of the day, I would rather have, you know, Seth Godin, this marketing guru expert guy, talks about having 1,000 true fans, your tribe. And really, if you think about that, 1,000, if you have 1,000 people backing you and that are like, will buy whatever you buy and love whatever you do, it's like, that's all you need. You can do amazing stuff if you have that kind, you know, if you have that kind of support. And back in the day, you had patrons, and there were patrons of the arts and people that funded this stuff. And, you know, we just found a way kind of very early on. And like you said, it was before Kickstarter even existed. We did a tour called the Friends and Family Tour or something. And we did another one that was like a $3 tour. And we were just kind of like doing, you know, early iterations of this essentially like microtransactional, it was crowdfunding, but we didn't know what it was called at that point. And we would go out and say, hey, would you contribute $3? You know, some people we reached by email, some people, Facebook was out at that point, but it was very early. We would reach people on Facebook. We would reach people on Friendster. You know, I like to kick it old school every now and again. You know, and MySpace, obviously, at that point was huge. And we would make these organic connections. And Andy is an amazing talent. And he translates with a live audience, especially his music translates really well. And so we ended up raising, I think, $45,000, you know, again, before there was ever a Kickstarter or anything like that. And that's another one of those moments that I'm really proud of in my career, because it was just, we didn't even know what we were doing. We were just like, okay, we need to go make this record. And then the record itself that we went out to LA and recorded with a producer named James Barber, who had worked with Ryan Adams and Amy Mann and a whole host of, you know, amazing artists, and ended up making this pretty cool record of top-notch talent and really cool songs and cool vibe and stuff. And it was all made possible, you know, by people believing in what we're doing, what he was doing. And so I'm hoping to tap into some of that energy and as I'm making this documentary, you know, and we launch our Kickstarter, the first part of 2019. I'm hoping to tap into some of that goodwill, even though, you know, it's crowdfunding has now become a little bit ubiquitous and it's definitely more saturated than it used to be. I'm still optimistic about that.
Yeah, I think if you have a cool project or something that's interesting and reaches a whole bunch of people, it can gain momentum.
Yeah, definitely.
Like that ska movie like fulfilled its Kickstarter like goal instantaneously, and it was like they were blown away by that. So
yeah, and see that's the interesting thing about mine. I mean, I've got some. I'm interviewing some people that definitely have some name brand recognition, but really my story is not about, my story has never been about like the big time. It's about doing what you love to do and being around awesome people and having great experiences and still being able to like pay your bills and, you know, buy lunch and have a roof over your head. And I'm just been thankful that I've been able to do that for as long as I have. But it's not really this, like that ska movie, when you look at it, it's like, yeah, there's like, everybody is in it. So yeah, if you were a fan, I mean, you know, it's like, it's a no brainer. Whereas I feel like ours is a little bit more about the kind of everyman and like the guy working in London or in Tokyo somewhere in his basement making some record that 100 people are going to hear, but that's okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be about, I think true art is, you know, we get so confused all the time with art and commerce because they're blended together constantly. But I mean, like when you really think about a band who is a truly artistic band, you will never hear of them because they are only doing it for a very small group of people. I think that there's some exceptions to that, but most bands, if you ask them, like, do you want to play the rest of your career in front of like 20 people, or would you like to play Madison Square Garden? Nobody says, that's not really for me. You know, if they're really being honest, like, I don't want fans. I don't want people to love my music. I don't want people to care about what I'm doing. Like, nobody really, really, really thinks that. And the people that do are people that you'll never hear their music because they're playing it for their close friends and family. And that's it. You know, I think there's something so cool about that. I would say if you want, I would love, if anybody actually recognizes the Combat Chuck character out there, if we've ever met, if we have hung out, if we have told stories to each other in a parking lot of a Safeway or Rite Aid across America, if we've ever had any sort of interaction, positive only. I don't want any negative stories. I would seriously like love to hear from you. There's a couple of ways to get a hold of me. Creative for Hire on Instagram is a great, I'm assuming you'll have show notes of some sort.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It'll so we'll put the links in there, but Creative for Hire is my Instagram account, and I'm like a 26-year-old, I am completely addicted to the social medias. And so I use Instagram all the time. And then check out our studio because we're doing some really cool stuff. as we upgrade and kind of bring modernize this recording studio, I think there's something really important about repurposing places that were originally built, purpose-built for creativity. I think that's something that's important because these places are getting torn down all the time. So people out there listening, if you have like an old radio studio or theater or someplace that was created for creativity in your hometown, like I want what we're doing here in Springfield, Missouri to be kind of like almost like a pilot project. Like, oh, that's cool what they're doing. We could do that, you know, here in Macomb, Illinois. Our studio is called Mozark Sound, MozarkSound.com. Mozark Sound. And there's a little bit about the documentary up there, and you can send me an email and say hello and all that stuff.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man.
Man, thank you. This was awesome. I feel like we've journeyed down 20 miles of bad road.
Thanks for listening to As the Story Grows. Our theme song was written and composed by the legendary Bob Nana. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes and give the show a rating and review. If you'd like to support the show financially, click on the Patreon link at asthestorygrows.com. If you enjoyed this episode, share it on social media with your friends. Much appreciated, and thanks for listening.